You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Yes, you are indeed tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current events.
If we make it that
analysis
long.
Analysis starting now. Yes, tēnā koutou katoa, ko skapres tokungua. No mai haramai ki te wire mo tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Thursday Wire for Rapari Thursday the
21st.
It is the 21st. Well done, Ben. It's Oscar and your host, and I'm joined by Ben and Grace today. How are both of you in a maximum of 17 words today? Got a few
I don't
more.
Have 17 words.
Is there a minimum?
4.
I think the audience gets the message.
I guess they do as well. On today's show, Andrew Little returns to talk to myself about our relations with China and the upcoming strengthening the criminal justice systems for victims survey. Grace talks to who?
Jerry Devlin.
Of?
The Heart Foundation.
About?
Heart disease.
In?
Oh my god, this is like one of those ad-lib things.
New Zealand.
Yes.
I also talked to Auckland Action Against Poverty's Ricardo Menendez March about the waiting list for state housing in New Zealand and the state, just the general state of state housing. And finally, on this day in history, Benjamin.
Richard Nixon went to China.
He did indeed.
Shook hands with his Zhao Enlai. Zhao Enlai.
Indeed. So, tukapatu mai, send through a text to 5395, or why am I? You can call the studio to chat with us on 309-3879 if you feel that way inclined. If you feel that way inclined, we'd love to hear from you. So we'll just dive in from here. Here is a bit of background to the next piece, which is my talk with Ricardo Menendez March. So the government has seen the social housing waiting list double since it took power, and the urgent wait list for people looking to be placed on social housing in New Zealand has now passed 10,000 people, which is quite a few people. I talked to Auckland Action Against Poverty's Ricardo Menendez March about this waiting list for state housing, starting by asking what AAAP or Auckland Action Against Poverty say the cause of this is.
Well, I mean, it boils down to the number of people that are homeless is not always reflected in the social housing waiting list. And the reasons for that is the previous governments have changed the eligibility criteria to be able to enter a state home. So when the Labor government changed it, they did see a rapid increase. But the causes are the same. It's a lack of affordable private rentals and a welfare system that stops people from being able to afford basic costs of living, which means more and more people are being put in a situation where they just have nowhere to live. And we're seeing record rents in places like Wellington, Auckland, and Tauranga. So it is no surprise to us that the number of people requiring social housing is really high levels at the moment.
You kind of mentioned it's reflective of homelessness and statistics. The Housing Minister, Phil Twyford, has also said that this is reflective of large numbers of hidden homeless who are now being reflected in statistics. Do you think this is a fair comment, or does this, although it may be true, kind of dismiss the issue that is at the heart of the topic?
Oh, look, I don't think the Minister can use that as an excuse to not be building enough state homes to cater for the need. If Minister Phil Twyford was aware that there was a greater number of so-called hidden homeless, his government should have planned ahead to build enough state homes to meet this now visible demand. We've got a government that is putting far too much priority into building private housing that will be inevitably unaffordable for the people on the waiting list, and is only devoting about a third of the resources of Crown land to build state homes. So this is a matter of priority. Phil Twyford knew since taking office that the level of need was incredibly high, so I don't think this should excuse the little action we have seen to address the demand.
Although we have seen this increase in numbers for the waiting list, we've also seen the development and conversion of 1,658, I believe, new state and community homes last year, which is the largest increase in stock of state housing in a decade. From this, I have two questions. What else do you believe the government can and should do to fix this kind of issue? And should we also perhaps not be seeing this high rate of production of state and community homes as a reflection of good work by the coalition government, but perhaps a statement about all the government's work and commitment to state housing in the last decade?
I think it's absolutely the latter. I mean, you know, it is true, of course, that this government is doing more than the previous government when it comes to building state housing. But I don't believe that the benchmark should be doing more than the previous administration. The benchmark we should set for any government is about whether they're doing enough to meet the demand of people that do not have a place to live. And so despite this government building more state homes than the previous one, it is still not enough. And when we see that most of the resources are being spent building private housing, that two-thirds of the developments in places like South Auckland are going into private homes instead of state homes, it tells me that the priorities are still wrong and that there is still far more that they can do to put the resources to build enough state homes that will match the demand that we're seeing in the social housing waiting.
Do you think we see issues with comparing governments to the last government? Do you think that this is like a valid form of working out how well a government is doing? You bring up the very valid point that if there's still a need, then it doesn't matter if you did better than the last government. But do you think governments often hide behind that kind of comparative analysis?
Absolutely. And this is not just on housing, but I would say in any issue. I mean, from wages to health outcomes and anything else. Look, I mean, for those of us that are advocating for universal access to housing, health and education, having a government that is telling us they're doing a little bit more than the previous one doesn't cut it, because we know that there's resources to do even more. And one of the reasons, you know, that the Labor government is not doing it is because of things like fiscal policies that they've set themselves that economists have criticized. And they're sitting in a $5 billion surplus where they could be investing that money into infrastructure and increase standards of living. So, yeah, having that benchmark set, I think, allows governments to get away with doing the bare minimum work, because so long as they're seen to be doing more than the previous government, they probably think they've got an escape. And that means we get very tiny incremental changes between administrations when they do happen.
So the average wait time on this social housing list is now 157 days, which is an increase of 122 days from a year ago. This is, of course, however, affected by outliers. So the median wait time for a house is 98 days, which is not much better. However, I was wondering, what effect does this wait time have on people looking to be placed in housing?
Oh, look, it has really detrimental effects, because for many people, either they'll be in the streets, they'll be in precarious situations such as couch surfing between homes, or they'll be in motels, many of them, as a recent investigation by Stuff showed, don't even meet the building code standards, or you know, they're cockroach infested and have blood-stained sheets. And so this actually has long-term effects on people's health, physical and mental. And it actually is a really costly, you know, wait for the government itself, because while they're waiting for a state home, they're actually, the government is spending millions of dollars on the motels. This is resources that could be used to also increase the public housing stock, which would be far more cost efficient and provide a permanent solution. So people suffer a lot during those 90 days. And I would say that a lot of the outliers that Phil Twyford is dismissing are the people that have been failed the most by successive government, because nobody should be waiting such a long time to get access to a home.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Yes, that was Ricardo Menendez March from Auckland Action Against Poverty. Now, Grace,
yes.
A piece by you.
Right, so I spoke to Jerry Devlin, medical director at the Heart Foundation and cardiologist at Gisborne Hospital, about New Zealand's biggest killer, heart disease. So I started by asking him about how big of an issue heart disease is in New Zealand.
Yeah, I mean, heart disease, since 1968 when the Heart Foundation was founded, over 50 years ago, we celebrated our 50th anniversary last year. We've had seen a dramatic reduction in deaths from heart disease. So if we look at people dying from heart attacks or blockages in the arteries, that's reduced by about 70% alone. However, one in five New Zealanders will still die from heart disease, and it's also one of the most frequent causes of health loss. So there's lots of people living with heart disease in our community, more than we've ever had before, and that our challenge is to help New Zealanders not just reduce mortality or death from heart disease further, but also help support New Zealanders living with heart disease well in the community.
So what factors have you seen contribute to heart disease in New Zealand?
Well, we know the traditional risk factors, don't we? We know that heart disease is a factor of getting older. So as we get older, we're much more likely to develop heart disease. But also, we see one in five people who present with heart disease due to heart attacks are less than 60. So the traditional risk factors that we all know that are associated with heart disease are smoking, high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol. They're the classical ones that we see, and also family history. We also know that being more active reduces our likelihood of developing heart disease, stroke. And don't forget, when we talk about heart disease and the risk factors that we just mentioned for heart disease, by addressing those risk factors, you also reduce your risk of having a stroke. So it's really important. You know, the Heart Foundation would recommend activity of 30 minutes of reasonably vigorous exercise 6 days a week. What that means is going out for a walk, and you get a sweat up with that. But if you can't do that, any exercise is better than no exercise. More exercise is better than a little, but any exercise is better than no exercise. And it's been shown in a number of trials repetitively that there is a benefit in reducing the chances of developing heart disease.
So why do you think that we've got such high rates of heart disease in New Zealand?
Well, as I say, we've come a long way with it, but it is, you know, if you look at heart disease around the world, it is, you know, the prevalence is high around the world. The incidence is high around the world. It is something that we have not got rid of. We will not get rid of heart disease. But what we want to try and do is reduce the likelihood of people dying early from heart disease. By early, I mean in their 60s. You know, we're all living longer, and our challenge is to help people live well. So if you look at those traditional risk factors that we talked about, we've come a long way with smoking as well, but we are still on a journey to smoke-free arterial in 2025. And blood pressure, I think blood pressure is something that we probably don't pay as much attention to as we should as health professionals. The latest evidence in the United States suggests that one in two Americans have not got elevated blood pressure. I would estimate that if we apply guidelines around blood pressure and new diagnosis of blood pressure to New Zealand, we would be pretty similar. And the problem with blood pressure is that, you know, you and I don't know we've got elevated blood pressure because there's usually no symptoms from it. It's picked up when you have a check with a health professional.
So what does the Heart Foundation do?
Well, the Heart Foundation's been supporting research since its inception in the late 1960s. And we've invested over $70 million in research and training. And I think those two things are integral to the role of the Heart Foundation and also the support we provide for New Zealanders. Most cardiologists around the country will have received Heart Foundation support during their career, be it for research they've been involved with or to go overseas for clinical fellowship. The clinical fellowships are really important to us because people, you know, we send young cardiologists overseas to come back and learn skill sets that they may have difficulty getting sufficient volume training, come back to New Zealand so that all New Zealanders benefit from that. But the other thing is not to forget is the research and supporting the research community and the development of a research community in New Zealand. And that's not just doctors, that's scientists, other people involved in research. And I think that's really important. It's something that we see as a vital role of the Heart Foundation is not just supporting the next generation of clinicians, but the next generation of researchers. What's also important to us is not just addressing big problems at an international level, but also problems that are specific to us in New Zealand. So if we look at New Zealand, we know the burden of heart disease falls unequally on our Māori and Pacific communities. Māori are 1.4 times more likely to have heart disease than non-Māori, for example. They're much more likely, twice as likely to die of heart disease, and those deaths, the median age for Māori dying of heart disease is 65, as opposed to European, which is around 80. So we don't fully understand that. The research that we're trying to support is addressed We have a strong focus and interest in trying to address those issues in New Zealand to improve equity of care for all New Zealanders with heart disease.
So is there anything that you would like every New Zealander to know about heart disease?
We've come a long way, but heart disease is still New Zealand's number one killer. We've got a long way to go with heart disease. There are more New Zealanders living than ever before with heart disease. You know, the challenge we've all got and the Heart Foundation has got is to not take our foot off the pedal with our battle against heart disease, and also to, you know, the Heart Foundation and its role to help not just with research and clinical fellowships, but also to help support New Zealanders living with heart disease to live well in our community.
So what is the purpose of the Big Heart Appeal?
Well, the big Heart Appeal is our annual appeal, Grace. It gives us the opportunity to firstly acknowledge the support we've had for many years from New Zealanders, and thank you all to all Kiwis for that, but also to get the message across that we have, whilst we've come a long way, we've still got a lot of work to do, and we're asking New Zealanders to continue to support the Heart Foundation in our efforts with trying to reduce further mortality from heart disease and help New Zealanders live well with heart disease in our community.
So the Heart Foundation is mainly funded by donations, I believe?
It is, yes.
So I just want to finish by asking you what responsibility you think that the government might have in alleviating heart disease.
Well, the government does have responsibilities. I mean, our DHBs are funded by the government. I also am an advisor to the government with heart disease. And the government, they found that heart disease is important for New Zealanders. They are involved. I mean, the government supported guidelines around development of new guidelines that are contemporary guidelines around prevention of heart disease and management of people at risk of heart disease. And they were, you know, they were published last year. The government understands its role, and the government are proactive, and they work with the Heart Foundation and other bodies, including the DHBs, in our ongoing battle with heart disease.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Who was that one?
That was Jerry Devlin, medical director at the Heart Foundation.
Speaking about
heart disease, Oscar.
Indeed. He was indeed. We'll be back after the break. We'll have Andrew Little, but we'll just have a little break for now.
Hakarongo mai, it's Māori words. Because he waka eke noa.
Upoko maro. Hardhead. Stubborn.
Okay, we've measured it, timed it, googled it, had a race, asked your uncle, gone to the Citizens Advice Bureau. Are you ready to admit my way of getting home is faster, or are you just going to keep on being an upoku maro?
I can't help that I know I'm right.
Upoku maro. Hardhead. Stubborn.
Māori words. Karawhiua. Give it a go. February.
Oh yeah, that's nice. That's real nice.
March.
Yep, real nice.
April.
Still nice.
May.
Still just, wow, really good.
June.
Oh boy, lovely stuff. Can you keep this up though?
Spoiler, he did. It's been quite the build-up. 12 perfectly formed song droplets squeezed out over 12 glorious months. Now, appreciate them in the flesh as 95BFM presents Lawrence Arabia's Singles Club album release tour. Stopping twice at the Hollywood Avondale on April 26th and 27th. Listen to 95BFM all this week for chances to win tickets with your B-card.
Ko te Wire, tēnei marunga BFM. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. If you have any thoughts to share with us, please send through your text to 5395 or call us on 309 3879 and one of the wonderful Grace or Ben will pick up your calls. We're now back after that little break to listen to Andrew Little, so I'll just cue the intro.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
Indeed, it is. This week we discussed New Zealand's relationship with China and the media's inflation with over the kind of issues that apparently we're facing, as well as the crime survey about for the new reformations on the justice system called Strengthening the Criminal Justice System for Victims Survey, and so that will be ongoing over the course of the next few months, and here's Andrew Little to talk about that. I started by asking him what format the survey would take and what they're kind of hoping to achieve from it.
It's an online survey, and there's a lot of open-ended questions. The idea is to hear from victims themselves about their experiences and really to focus on what it is that the broader criminal justice system, right from the police to the courts to whatever else, can be done to better support victims of crime. We know, and I know from feedback I get from a lot of victims, particularly serious crime, is that often they feel completely lost in the system. They feel like they're a bit player. They don't really know at what points they get to have a say. And although we've got a good victim support network and what have you, what you actually need is people who can advocate for victims at every step of the way to make sure that their voice is heard. So it's about hearing from victims to see what it is that we can improve in the system that's going to, I think, make it fairer for them.
It says that the results from the survey will inform Dr. Kim McGregor's advice to the government. What is Dr. Kim McGregor's role in this process, and what is this advice-giving process?
She's the Chief Government Victims Advisor, so it was a role set up by the previous government as trying to draw together information that goes into the Ministry of Justice, to the police, to other agencies, and then advise the government on things that could be improved. It's a very much a part-time role. I've expanded it in the time I've been minister. But I think what it does tell us is that there is a need for a lot more support for victims. So she is leading up a workshop that we're running in 2 or 3 weeks' time in Wellington of victims and victims' advocates and those associated with supporting victims. This follows on the Criminal Justice Summit that we had in August last year, the kind of offshoot of that. So they're meeting for 2 days. Preliminary results of the survey will be fed into that workshop, and that workshop will be the basis on which Dr. McGregor pulls together various suggestions and proposals and ideas and advises me and the Safe and Effective Justice Advisory Group, who are putting together their big report for later this year on reforms that we should make in the criminal justice system.
Right, so that leads quite well into the next question. As you've mentioned, the advice will go in towards workshops and the Hapatia Te Oranga Tangata and Safe Effective Justice Program. Is that justice program a new subsection of the ministry, or is this simply for this issue and it's a working group?
The Hapatia program is the overall program of criminal justice reform that we kicked off last year. The Criminal Justice Summit was part of it. This victims workshop is part of it. We've got a Hui Māori coming up in April. That's part of it. And we've got the Te Iupu, which is the advisory group. They are part of the total program of reform. They are those forums and that group are the basis on which we're pulling together ideas for proposals for change in the criminal justice system.
Right. Is there anything that you think is likely to come up in the results of these surveys?
If my conversations with victims and the correspondence that I get from victims is anything to go by, I expect to hear about better ways that the system can support victims. I know I dealt with a family member of somebody who was the victim of a homicide. I met with them early last year, my time as minister, and it was interesting hearing from them. They were in a small rural town, and they felt as if they had no support whatsoever. They thought the police gave them some information about victim support, presumably because the nearest victim support person was, you know, a couple of hours' drive away. They felt as if they didn't get any support at all. And then when it came to the trial and to sentencing and so on, they basically had to fight their own way to make sure that they got their rights as victims upheld. And that, you know, that just shouldn't be happening. I know I've heard from other victims who say if they've had to travel a distance to get to a trial, they've struggled to get reimbursement of costs and things like that. And I just think there's a lot more we can do to make it easier for victims to navigate the system. As I said in Parliament the other day, I mean, the reality is that victims are the one group of people in our criminal justice system who are not there because of any choice they've made or any action they've taken. It's because of what has happened to them, and it's a system that is very unaccommodating of them. So that's what I'm keen to see change.
It's certainly a very interesting point. So you would agree that it is important to put those who are victims of crime at the centre of creating a safer justice system?
Yeah, well, look, we've got a number of considerations we have to weigh up. Obviously, when it comes to dealing with offenders and defendants, there are some basic principles that innocent till proven guilty and right to a fair trial and those sorts of things. And we've built up a lot of institutions and rules around making sure those rights are upheld, but we've done less about ensuring that victims don't feel re-victimised or traumatised by the system that is meant to be delivering them justice as well.
Carrying on from that, do you think that we should listen to perpetrators of crime, both current and former, on what reforms and repeals they believe should be put in place?
And we do that. And I think they've certainly got plenty to offer about, in terms of their insights about their kind of journey through the system. And I'm particularly interested in the insights I get from offenders about the treatment they get after, usually after they've been sentenced, or even before sentencing, because I know, one of the gaps we have is that somebody is arrested or detained, they may be in the community or they may be remanded in custody, but they have issues that, you know, aren't usually related to addiction and things like that, or mental health, that they get no attention to until there's a conviction and a sentence, and they then might get some help. But even then, if they wind up in prison, there's often not a lot of help there. So I think there's a lot more that we can do for offenders to change their behaviours so that they are safer both for themselves and obviously for the community.
Yeah, certainly. It's a rather, almost like, yeah, holistic issue. Are there any other voices that you believe aren't currently being heard in the way our justice system operates that you think are integral in hearing?
I think, you know, the victims, obviously, because they're the ones who've been offended against. I think offenders, because we've built this whole system up that is actually meant to be not just about calling them to account, but actually, to the best extent we can, helping them or changing their behaviours. And that's an area where the system has fallen down. Of course, we've got, you know, the lawyers, the judges, the various others. We've got specialists like psychologists. They are very articulate and they are very well represented when it comes to the forums that we have to review the justice system periodically. But it's making sure that we're hearing from all voices. There is, of course, the community, and there's a variety of voices there. But in the end, I think what most people want to know is that we are striving for a system that is going to that keeps the community safe. And that is not to say that, you know, we'll ever stamp out crime completely, but that when it happens, there's an effective response that minimises the probability that a person who has offended once is going to offend again. We've got a long way to achieve that aspiration, but I'm confident that over time and with the right responses and doing the right things, we could do that.
Certainly, we can all hope. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to those points?
Yeah, you know, I think that probably covers the point.
Okay, so there's been a lot of talk about China and New Zealand and the relationship between the two countries in the media currently. However, from what I understand, it is at this point just that, a lot of discussion, although there have been some interactions. Some commentators have linked these kind of interactions or events to the coalition government's decisions or actions, i.e. some commentators have tried to link a downturn in Chinese enrollments in the New Zealand education system to the coalition government's actions, and some are speculating that exports aren't reaching China due to the government's rejection of the Huawei 5G network plan, which, may I add, from everything I've read and the import statistics, is perhaps factually incorrect. How do you currently perceive Aotearoa's relationship with China?
Look, I think it's as strong as it ever was. I think there's been a lot of overblown reports about things happening between New Zealand and China, but actually when you explore it and look at it, I've yet to see any report that says that exporters are not getting their goods into market. Likewise, importers not getting their stuff out of China. So that's happening. Tourist numbers are as high as they ever were. Student numbers might have decreased, but you know, there's an issue too internally in China. Their Chinese economy is slowing, and families that might once upon a time have afforded to send their child or children abroad for education, there's fewer of them doing that. So I think, you know, that might explain a small decline in enrollments from China. But largely, things are pretty much as they ever were, and the utterances that we're getting from officials of the Chinese government is that whatever problems there are, they're saying, can be resolved with discussion, and there is no major erosion of the relationship between the two countries.
Certainly, I think it's interesting, as you say, that the foreign ministry spokesperson for China, I believe it's Geng Shuang, said that this is like perhaps the media should listen to the Chinese government, not the Chinese newspapers that are supposedly reporting this as well. What would you ideally like to see the relationship between Aotearoa and China being?
Well, it's like our relationship with any other country, that we, you know, we have good people-to-people links, that we have good trade links, but we, you know, we preserve we preserve our sovereignty, and so we make our decisions for ourselves. We don't, in relation to any other country, we won't agree on 100% of everything there is going on. There'll be things that we disagree with. Like you look at Australia, not only our nearest sort of neighbour, but arguably our closest international friend. We disagree with some of the things that are happening there, particularly in relation to the deportation of New Zealand citizens, many of whom have actually little or no connection with New Zealand. Of course, we're going to call them out publicly on that, and we do, and we have. It doesn't stop us having an extraordinarily strong relationship with Australia. With China, they are a superpower. They're a big player in the world. We know they want goods that we produce and that we export. Why wouldn't we want to have that sort of relationship? But equally, we have to look to our broader interests and protect ourselves against any risks, and that's what we do. And sometimes there's behaviour by China, as there is with other countries, that we disagree with, and sometimes we call that out. But we maintain a good relationship otherwise.
Do you think New Zealand currently holds that relationship? Or if not, what steps do you think we should take to get to that point?
I think, look, our relationship with China goes back a long way. And if you have a look, and actually particularly when the Labor Party has been in government, whether on its own or in coalition, it's taken a lot of steps to advance that relationship. It was the Kirk government who, pretty much within weeks of being elected in 1972, opened diplomatic relations with China. We were the first country to recognise China as a market economy. That meant that they could get membership of the WTO. We were the first country in the world to get a free trade agreement with China. So, look, we've worked very hard to establish our relationship with China. As I say, there's things that happen in China that the Chinese government is responsible for that we don't like, that we're uncomfortable with. And we manage that, we deal with that. That comes up in the dialogue we have with China. But on the whole, we have a good relationship with China as a country. We welcome their people when they visit here or when they come to settle here. And that's the way it should be.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little. The Wire.
It was indeed Andrew Little.
What? Speaking of China, though, we've got this day in history about China.
Oh, you're not going to let the sting play, Ben?
Well, I just want to do a segue. That's professional radio.
As you do.
Welcome, citizens, to This Day in History with Benjamin J. Goldson.
This day in history, going back to 1972, for the first visit of a US president to the People's Republic of China, that was Richard Nixon, going over to meet his counterpart. And so this happened at a sort of odd period in the 20th century when you had China splitting with the Soviet Union and being drawn towards the United States. Something that in the sort of 1940s would have been seen as really sort of unexpected, given the United States' strong support for the Republic of China.
Yes.
You're jumping in here?
Are we?
Well, do you have something to say or not?
No, I'm just agreeing with what you're saying. Oh, carry on.
Thank you. Grace, do you want to agree with what I'm saying?
Not really.
Nanking, capital of China, nervously awaits the Communist Army encamped only 10 miles outside the city. Only Chiang Kai-shek's successor, acting President Lai Chung-yen, and Chu Chang-wei, his chief advisor, remain in the city to represent the government. Their mission is to seek peace with the Communists, acknowledged victors in the 22-year-old civil war. On the Great Yangtze River, which links Nanking with Shanghai, gunboats ferry remnants of the Nationalist Army to defend the capital in case peace talks fail. In the beleaguered city itself, the feeling runs high in favor of unconditional surrender. Troops add to the unbelievable congestion as streets are feverish with people in flight. With the refugee problem now completely out of hand, the Reds are making the most of their victor's spoils and are letting the armistice talks hang fire. Meanwhile, all China anxiously waits for peace.
So who are the Reds, just first
off? The Reds were the Chinese Communist Party led by Mao Zedong, which we're all aware of.
Yeah.
And so initially he brought China closer to the Soviet Union, as everyone expected. But then there were sort of divisions that emerged. Partly I think it's just because you've got two big countries and actually they're going to have their rivalries because they're quite close together. But there were also probably political disagreements over the successor to Soviet Premier Joseph Stalin, Khrushchev, who denounced Stalin in a sort of secret speech that immediately was leaked to the rest of the world.
Joseph Stalin, ruler of a sixth of the earth for 30 years, has been thrown from his pedestal. Colleague of Lenin in the stormy days when the Bolshevik Revolution shook the world, the man who took the mantle of Lenin when he died, Stalin is now officially branded a dictator by his own party through its spokesman, Comrade Khrushchev. The leader who is above criticism, the little father of his people, is convicted 3 years after his death of having ruled by terror. Lenin is said to have warned the party against giving Stalin too much power. Today, when thousands he purged are being declared innocent, when Russia has repaired the destruction of a war he would not foresee, his country must be remembering Lenin's warning. When Stalin died, his body was laid beside that of Lenin in the Red Square. Now Moscow's workers are petitioning to have it removed. But in those days, his colleagues would not dare to speak, for his name was still magic. To Britain, at the moment of Stalin's downfall, comes the man who briefly succeeded him, Georgi Malenkov, heading a delegation of electrical engineers. He visits the Premier, and to a gathering of labor leaders, he says, "We have cleaned up Russia. We have stopped the dictatorship. It cannot come back." The world hopes he will prove to be right.
Was he right?
I won't be drawn on that. But I'll just say that the Soviet system didn't change much after Stalin went. Maybe it was less centralized on one person, but anyway. So another division that emerged between... between China and Russia was over the Vietnam War. Initially, both sides were quite close to the North Vietnamese. However, they were increasingly drawn towards the USSR and away from China.
Spring at home, but unmindful of clock or calendar, the Vietnam struggle goes on. A Viet Cong ambush of a U.S. Marine Rough Rider truck convoy kills one American leatherneck, wounding four others. Many vehicles were damaged, two destroyed. Elsewhere, South Vietnamese and American troops keep supply lines open while attacking a huge Viet Cong installation. The enemy camp was first pounded by heavy fire from ships and landing boats, providing cover for the assault wave foot soldiers. When the smoke clears, the inevitable roundup of prisoners, many of them seriously wounded. Among the captured, a large group of women, traditionally used by the enemy as ammunition bearers, village infiltrators, and informers. At least 18 VC soldiers were killed in this joint Allied sweep. Battle-weary feet, a soldier's nemesis. The brief pause allows communication with the ever-present field choppers, which pick up both Allied wounded and the captured enemy. Spring at home, but in Vietnam.
That was part one of This Day in History. We'll be back after a little block of ads and perhaps a tune even. Ah, the sweet mystery and poetry of the camera. How does the subtle arrangement of glass, steel, and mirrors come together to produce images of such majesty, such pain? Is it cool to get a selfie stick for my DSLR?
Get the inside word on the world of photography with The Wide Angle, thanks to Nikon. A weekly in-depth chat between 95BFM's resident arts and culture expert Rachel Ashby and her esteemed photographic guests.
The Wide Angle, brought to you by Nikon, Sunday mornings in Art Bank, and with a well-posh extended podcast available at myNikonLife.co.nz.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. will be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck Knuckles, Cock and Piss, Malds. Thank you.
Christen the Spirit of 76 taxis to a stop on the runway of the Peking Airport. And Premier Zhou Enlai moves forward to greet the first American president to set foot on Chinese soil. East meets West as a handshake bridges 16,000 miles and 22 years of hostility. There are no welcoming speeches, no formal ceremonies, just a receiving line made up of Communist Party officials and the military band playing the Star-Spangled Banner. Ceremonies, brief but diplomatically correct, are quickly over, and the President and Premier are soon on their way. For President Nixon, a sudden change in schedule, a surprise meeting with Mao Zedong, an honor last bestowed during the first day of a state visit on former Premier Nikita Khrushchev. Dr. Henry Kissinger sits in on the talks that are animated, constructive, and frank. At the summit, face to face, two leaders who direct the destiny of one out of three persons on the earth. The gate to friendly contact, says Zhou Enlai, has finally been opened.
And always urgently, the world rolls on. Time passes. 10,000 years are too long. Seize the day. Seize the hour. This is the hour. This is the day.
President Nixon and Premier Zhou meet four times for a total of more than 8 hours. We cannot close the gulf between us, the president tells Zhou, but we can try to bridge it and continue to talk across it. Highlight of the historic journey, a visit to the Great Wall, once designed to keep Mongolian warriors from overrunning the frontiers of ancient China. The wall snakes across the countryside for 1,684 miles. A people that can build a wall like this, the president says, certainly have a great past to be proud of. As we look on this wall, Mr. Nixon adds, we do not want walls of any kind between people. Snow falls on Peking as the president's car on the fifth day travels toward the legendary Forbidden City.
As you can probably tell, we're back with This Day in History. Before the break, you heard a clip about China's involvement in the Vietnam War, and in that clip you just heard, what was going on, and what happened between those two clips, in history that is?
Oh, not in the system, that I think I messed something up and played it during this spot block. In Vietnam you had the USSR sort of pulling North Vietnam towards it, probably because of the sort of long-standing animosity between the Vietnamese and the Chinese, which goes back thousands of years. It's about the sort of Chinese Empire. And so into that gap moved the United States. Nixon sort of promised a lot of things to do with Vietnam and sort of modernizing Americans' right. foreign relations. And it was sort of a big coup for him, but it came quite surprisingly because Nixon actually had gotten his start in politics during the sort of 1950s McCarthyite period, which was a reaction to the fall of China to communists in the first place, which, oh, this is... And the idea was like, oh, this is a big conspiracy. We've got secret communists in the government that intentionally betrayed China to the Reds, and now he's going over to China, shaking hands with the Reds.
Right.
Well, it's just because he's like a cynical, awful politician.
Mm.
Yeah, take that, Richard Nixon. Big fan. I'm not afraid.
Christened the Spirit of 76, taxis to a stop on the runway of the Peking Airport. And Premier Zhou Enlai moves forward to greet the first American president to set foot on Chinese soil.
So after Nixon arrived and had his visit, like how did Chinese relations with America like grow from there?
I think they went a bit slow, but once you get into the sort of 80s, 90s, you got the economy opening up, China now being the sort of manufacturing base for the American, you know, empire, financial empire. It's still obviously a complex relationship. You watch the news now, obviously all the stuff going with Huawei.
Yeah, there's a discussion about the kind of America. You mentioned like the colonization of like...
It's like Vietnam.
Yeah, of Vietnam before off air. We were talking about how perhaps the Vietnamese swayed more towards the USSR due to perhaps old colonial ties. And then you were talking about investment after the war in Vietnam by the...
By the Russians.
By the Russians.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of it is also the USSR was just a lot further away from Vietnam, so it is less of an immediate, you know, threat to them.
Yeah. So in the modern day as well, you talk about this kind of the promise of infrastructure as Nixon supposedly promised, and we see these kind of same conversations being had by both countries still today in areas like the Pacific. Do you think this is just what will continue to happen onwards and onwards past?
Yeah, I think it's just in the nature of big sort of, big sort of quasi-imperial states like China or America. And it's always the way when you want to sort of colonize an area is you start by, you know, oh, we'll build you a bunch of bridges and infrastructure, and then that's, you got your hooks.
Yeah, soft sort of, kind of colonization.
I don't even know if that's particularly soft, but
that's
softer
true.
Than just marching in with a bunch of troops.
Yeah. Anyways, that was this day in history.
Yeah, sorry about all the sort of mess-ups, guys. It's not been a good day for me. I'm pretty tired.
It's okay, Ben.
We all have our off days.
We wanted to do a quick, brief update on an announcement that was going to be made today and has been made today, and that was on the Tax Working Group. The Tax Working Group were working on a recommendation for the government about where to go with tax policy, and the kind of primary... topic of conversation was the capital gains tax. So that announcement has been made, what, an hour ago about?
More or less.
Yeah, and so what came from that working group? What was included in those announcements, Ben?
Well, the big one, as you said, is the capital gains tax.
So has that been recommended to adopt?
Yeah, officially recommended. And so I think it's sort of a danger for the government because for whatever reason... New Zealanders don't seem to like a capital gains tax. I don't know if it's just that it is the policy itself or how it's been presented.
I think it's been a lot of kind of spooking about.
Yeah, I do think, because New Zealand, we've obviously got that tradition of having the sort of batch, the second home, and I guess that would come under the thing. And you could say, well, if, you know, if people have worked all their life and they buy themselves a batch, should that be taxed in the same way that if you, you know, buy a bunch of stocks and shares and you sell those, should that get taxed the same way?
Yeah.
So maybe that is a sure concern.
Perhaps some of these things will be discussed in the kind of complexities of the legislation. But
yes, but it's like, isn't that what the working group was supposed to do?
I'm sure they perhaps did address these things. But I mean, there was talks of it being not just a second property, but like third and fourth. I think who's the National Party MP? Todd, not Barclay, the other
McClay.
One. McClay.
There we go.
Apparently. There was word floating around the office that he was concerned as to whether his support would be determined on whether it was a third or fourth home, which is an interesting thing to discuss considering, especially after the state housing piece, But yes, so that's a brief update on the tax working group. I'm sure you'll hear more about this in the news throughout the next day and throughout the rest of the day today, Thursday, the 21st of February. That was Your Wire for today.
That was The Wire.
It was indeed. So today we talked to and have a lot of people to thank, actually. Grace, would you like to thank?
Yes, so thanks to Jerry Devlin from the Heart Foundation.
Ricardo Menendez March of Auckland Action Against Poverty. And as always, thank you to Andrew Little for joining us for our regular chat. And thank you to Ben and Grace and the rest of the news team for supporting us, and Amelia for helping fix our
brief disaster.
Very brief disaster.
Hey, and thank you, Oscar, as well. I need to have someone to thank. I sound like an arsehole if I didn't.
Cheers, Ben.
He's choking up with emotion.
I am. I don't know what to say. Anyway, here is Maybe I'll See You in Your Dreams by Zen Mantra before the 1-4 show with Sigrid, I believe. Everything that you heard today will be podcast online later. 95bfm.com/bcasts, I believe.
I might not podcast this day in history, much of a disaster it was.
Pity party, that was in our top 10 last night even.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.